We have a completely independent market from whatever is going on in your local area. I think it's going to be a game changer. It's going to be a lot of game theory and testing out ideas, but it's going to change power markets as we know them.
This is the Blue Collar Bitcoin Podcast, a show where average Joe firefighters explore the most important monetary technology of the 21st century. We talk Bitcoin, we talk finance, and we talk shit. What is up, folks, and welcome back into this week's installment of Blue Collar Bitcoin. Josh and myself, Dan, were delighted to be joined this week by a humble and insanely intelligent gentleman from the Great White North, Mr. Ryan McLeod. On Twitter, you may know him as Nuclear Bitcoiner. Ryan is a laboratory technologist at Canadian Nuclear Laboratories. He works in the nuclear lab by day and ducks S9 Bitcoin miners into his dryer at home by night. A true hard-nosed, blue-blooded pleb. In the first half of this discussion, we explore many fascinating facets regarding nuclear energy and its implications. Then in the second half, we dive into how Bitcoin may step in as a catalyst for nuclear energy in the decades moving forward. Ryan spearheaded a team that put together a paper regarding Bitcoin mining with small modular nuclear reactors, something that got enough attention to where they recently presented this paper at an international nuclear conference in Japan. The paper is linked down in the show notes on our website if you'd like to take a peek at this thesis. The longer Josh and I are in this space, the more our minds are blown and stretched by the number of diverse areas this seemingly simple protocol touches. In particular, the implications of Bitcoin on energy production seem to be escalating rather quickly. A reminder, ladies and gents, that if you haven't gotten them yet, get your Bitcoin 2023 tickets. Josh and I will both be in Miami Beach for the conference May 18th to the 20th, 2023. We can attest this event is next level. The education and access are off the charts, but the networking and fellowship with kindred spirits is what makes this event really special. You can support our show and get 10% off tickets with code BCB23. That's code BCB23. Folks, CoinKite makes so much cool shit, it's hard for us to even know what to talk about each week. Today, we'll zero in on the block clock. The block clock is that cool-looking thing sitting in the office or background of what seems to be every serious Bitcoiner on the planet. Both the Block Clock Mini and the Block Clock Micro look even cooler in person than you're expecting. You can easily program these beauties to display a plethora of cool-as-hell Bitcoin metrics, from price to block height to the next halving date and way more. The Block Clocks are devices made for Bitcoin nerds, but the CoinKite team has ensured they are aesthetically pleasing enough to the point where your wife or husband might even allow it in your living room. You can support our show and pick up a Block Clock Mini or Block Clock Micro by going to our CoinKite affiliate link down in the show notes. And if you're looking to pick up a cold card, use promo code BCB for 5% off. That's code BCB. Okay, enjoy this show with Nuclear Bitcoiner.
All views and language expressed by the hosts and guests in this podcast are solely their personal opinions and do not reflect their employers or organizations they are associated with. Do not treat any of the content in this podcast as investment advice or as an inducement to follow a particular strategy. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only.
Ryan, welcome on Blue Collar Bitcoin, my friend.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed your show quite a bit.
Thanks for joining us. We're hoping maybe you can shed some light on this invisible boogeyman that is nuclear energy. And I'm going to mispronounce nuclear like 100 times during this because for some reason today I can't say the word. So just forgive me throughout this.
You've been drinking, dude? What do you got?
No, show us. I don't know what's going on, man. I think maybe I need to get the frenulum snipped on my tongue today or something. You know, it's just a little slagging.
I'm going to crack a beer here, gentlemen. I've drifted away from doing this during the show because I have a propensity to sound like more and more of a clown the more beers I drink, but we may regress tonight. You know, one thought I had, Josh, moving into this episode and reading your essay, Small Modular Reactors and Proof of Work Digital Asset Mining in Bitcoin, is that his job as a nuclear scientist might just be slightly more complex than what we do for a living, Josh. It's hard to say, though.
I don't know. It's far-fetched, but I mean, I could see a world where that could be possible. Maybe.
We're pumped to talk to you, man. I mean, you've got an expertise that we don't get around much, so we're gonna ask a lot of questions tonight, and we appreciate you joining us.
No, I'm up for it. But yeah, I must stress, though, I'm certainly not an expert. Like, my deep nuclear research is more as a hobbyist. Like, I work in the industry as a laboratory technologist. So I do lab analysis that supports a lot of the research and safety and just ongoing maintenance of the Canadian nuclear fleet. But yeah, I have learned a lot from being around the nuclear scientists and the engineers, and I have them accessible for asking whatever questions I might have, and I've done the history and know it fairly well. But yeah, I'm definitely a long ways away from a nuclear engineer.
Well, I think it's safe to say you're a lot closer to a nuclear scientist than Dan or myself, so we'll take your word for whatever you're going to say here. I think Dan and I, you know, we're pretty close to doctors. We come in pretty close contact with them on a daily basis, you know, driving people to the hospital. So it's fair. It's a safe assumption to say we're as close to doctors as you are to a nuclear scientist then, roughly.
It's the proximity effect.
I support their work, yeah. What I do supports their ability to do what they need to do. It's a small cog in a very, very large industry.
A true pleb, Josh.
Yeah, we love the humility.
Pleb mindset.
I was just in the right place at the right time when I started to catch on to Bitcoin. And then I read all the news that my company's getting into small modular reactors. And then you start learning about Bitcoin mining and its relationship to energy and how they're using it on stranded energy assets like the flared gas, or trying to use methane off of the landfills and waste sources such as that. And I figured it was small modular reactors and Bitcoin mining just kind of made sense.
So is that how you kind of get introduced to the idea of Bitcoin? Is it through your job, through the energy sector where people were talking about it there? Or did you take it from the outside and bring the idea around?
No, I had, like everybody, been exposed to Bitcoin sometime long in the past. Like, I was supported like Ron Paul in like the pay attention to the Fed kind of stuff. And every once in a while, Max Kaiser would come up in some of the content I was consuming. And then I moved on with my life and family and work and several jobs in the interim, and then I had cashed out from an online poker site, and they offered Bitcoin cash out. So I spun up a wallet, cashed out to it, and then just left it and ignored it for 3 years. This would have been like 17, 18, and then the big run up in January of 21, then I was like, oh, this few hundred dollars is now worth a few thousand dollars. So I started to actually take it seriously. And I jumped right off the deep end going into Max's podcast, and then that quickly led me to like Safety and Sailor, Breedlove and Valis, and yeah, my whole podcast list just went orange, as many do when you get obsessed with this technology. And then at one point, my wife and I were talking when Elon was flooding the energy use after that had the spring crash. She threw out the idea of mining with small modular reactors because, yeah, she works for the company as well. And then I just kind of ran with that idea and started just cold messaging people I was hearing on podcasts. And then eventually Greg Foss was the first one that kind of picked up, and he was like, yeah, this sounds like a great idea. Tell me more. And here's someone else that was working with it. So then that connected me with some other people. And then as you start venturing down the rabbit hole, you start to find out that you're not alone, and then eventually you get on Twitter, and then the whole world opens up to you, and Bitcoin Twitter just find all kinds of new internet friends. And
the warm embrace of Bitcoin Twitter.
Yeah. Then this competition came up. It was that's what the paper that I had sent you guys for, the basically mining Bitcoin with small modular reactors. This North American Young Generation in Nuclear was hosting this contest called Innovation for Nuclear, and they were looking for ideas to use nuclear power to apply to the UN Sustainable Development Goals, just like ending poverty, better healthcare, better infrastructure. Like, the goals on their face value are reasonable. Like, it's questionable how certain international institutions are pursuing those goals, and all. And I'm sure a lot of Bitcoiners are not a big fan of the UN and the way they pursue their ends. But I figured I would give it a shot, and I put a team together and put this idea out there, and we won this contest and got to present at an international nuclear conference in Japan just a few months ago. And that was a week after adopting Bitcoin, where I just randomly asked if I could present, and they accepted my application and took my wife to El Salvador for a vacation and did a little presentation at the Bitcoin conference on the side. It was awesome.
Very cool. What was the reaction at the nuclear event? What kind of people came up to you afterward? What kind of pushback did you get? Was anybody truly enamored by it and potentially going to take action?
Yeah, for the most part, they were very much intrigued by the idea. And considering this was like weeks after the FTX imploded, I was expecting a little bit more dismissiveness from the audience at the nuclear conference. But surprisingly, they were very much into it. Like once you kind of get the idea a little bit fleshed out and explain to them just how it's like in applying Bitcoin mining to deploying remote nuclear reactors or just the existing fleet, it's just basically insurance on surplus generation. You just always have that customer at the edge to take up whatever you've got extra.
So I think let's take a step back here and start kind of from the beginning. I think there's a propensity for a lot of people to get immediately scared when they hear the words nuclear energy. They think of Chernobyl, they think of Fukushima, maybe they think of Three Mile Island, some of the circumstances that turned out kind of negative for the industry, besides Three Mile Island. I think that worked out just fine. They contained it. But let's talk about some true basics of nuclear energy, how it works, and explain why it isn't the boogeyman that so many people think it is.
Well, nuclear power is, it's been a very important part of our energy systems for the last 60, 70 years. It's a very controlled reaction that controls the process of fission in a harnessed way that allows us to convert the energy from the nuclear fission process into steam that can then be converted into electricity by running it through a turbine. It's basically just engineering, and each iteration of generations of reactors have improved significantly on like different safety protocols and means to ensure that no incidents like Fukushima or Chernobyl could happen again. Like Chernobyl, I'm sure as many people have watched the movie, a lot of that was related to poor communication between management and operations, and that they were kind of pushing this old reactor design beyond its original design limits. And you take risks like that, bad things can happen. And then Fukushima was a learning lesson that you have to make sure that you have backup power. If you lose your diesel backup power and you lose cooling to your reactor, bad things will happen. So now the Japanese are building fortresses around their reactors with 20-meter-tall, 3-meter-thick concrete walls that will protect them from even the largest of tsunamis that Mother Nature can throw at them. And then on top of that, to secure their generators, they're basically putting them on floating reservoirs so that the water will fill up beneath them and the diesel generator will just float above that and not be submerged, so they will always have backup power. So it's very impressive. They're spending a lot of money to make these reactors ready, and it looks like in the next few years they are going to be sequentially bringing them online, which also makes the announcement, I don't know if you guys heard, that the Japanese grid operator TEPCO is going to start Bitcoin mining or something along those lines to absorb surplus energy on their grid, and turning on a bunch of nuclear reactors is going to have a lot of surplus generation that's going to need to be absorbed. So it's going to be interesting to see the dynamic of how they use it to kind of buffer the restart of their reactor fleet. I think that's part of this plan. It's going to be something worth watching.
It's kind of wild. Like every single kind of power that's generated is effectively a steam engine. When you go down to the, you know, basic bare bones of how it works, it's kind of insane that effectively we've just created new ways to create heat. We haven't really created a new way to create energy since we've invented it. It's still a steam engine, effectively. Kind of nuts.
Just so happens that nuclear is the most efficient steam engine of all. While we're on this risks of nuclear topic, we may be deep diving on this a little bit early, but it is one of my priorities in this episode. One thing that comes to mind for me is someone that's naive to nuclear. I understand that a lot of this stuff is completely overblown. Like, for example, one stat I pulled out in preparation for this episode was that if you add up Chernobyl, Fukushima, and even throw 3 Mile in there, the combined loss of life from that pales in comparison to the amount of loss of life that happens from, say, coal energy production in a given year. And that's nuclear technology from back in the 60s and 70s. So we've come a long way. It's kind of like airplanes in the sense that the incidents are dramatized in a way that sticks in your brain, but the actual numbers tell a different story. Having said that, nuclear energy nuclear weaponry, anything with nuclear in front of it, is a big fucking deal. And it needs to be handled safely and appropriately and probably slowly. So I drew this parallel in my head between the way Bitcoiners think through Bitcoin. We think through Bitcoin on like a centuries long timeline. We want that base layer to be ironclad, totally secure. The same thing would be true of nuclear. This doesn't need to work for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. This needs to work in a war zone in 80 years. Do you see viable risks to reactors in extremely precarious environments like that, where things are going completely south and haywire? Or are these things constructed so well in the 2020s that they can literally withstand any of these, we'll call them black swan events?
Yeah, from what I understand, like they are very well shielded in concrete. Like, you would need some pretty heavy ordnances to bust through a core and do any disruption from the outside. Like, I'm not saying that it's not impossible, but it would have to be done with like extreme intention that that is what you're doing. You would choose a specific ordinance to be busting through that level of shielding. Like, from what I understand, like that reactor in Ukraine, like, it did take a few stray missiles in like support buildings, but nothing was actually damaged in and around the actual reactor housing. So that is reassuring that is kind of holding the line. Yeah, the nuclear power industry, we pay the utmost respect for the what this technology is and how dangerous it can be when it does get out of hand. Like, the accidents are definitely sensationalized, but there are risks, there are hazards associated with dealing with radiological material and generating a lot of power through the process of fission. But a lot of the new reactor types have implemented new safety protocols that will enable them to, if they say they lose outside power, outside cooling, they will fail into a passive state rather than needing like something like active cooling, constantly keeping the rods cool. The new types of fuel will automatically dissipate the heat into the environment, and then they will cool down like on their own. We've got waste taken care of, like, for the most part. Like, we know how to do it. It's a technically solved issue, but it's just a matter of building the facilities that we need to. Like, I think Finland's going ahead with one. It's basically the plan is to build like well-managed, long-term retrievable storage sites so that we can bury them somewhere that's going to be safe for centuries, millennia, but we'll also have the ability to retrieve this stuff if it is needed in the future, because a lot of nuclear fuel these days only uses a small fragment of the available energy in the uranium fuel rods. So there is a likelihood that future technology, and maybe not so distant future, technology will be available to extract more of the available energy out of those fuel rods and prolong our ability to generate nuclear power well into the future. Like, there's already some reactors that can reprocess like the spent byproducts that come out of the traditional reactors. Like, I think the French and the Russians have reactors that have those capabilities that can use like the plutonium and the transuranics that are like basically all the other elements that are down around uranium in the periodic table. They can burn those out in the fission process, and then what that does is it decays them faster, so that ultimately when you get as much of the extractable energy out of them, a lot of the most harmful nucleides have been expired, and there is less of a harmful footprint of the final fuel product just to store in the end. Most of it will just be reduced down to inert salts.
So that waste is just much, much cleaner on reactors that exist today and are going to probably exist right. More in the future. They're able to, basically the byproducts are much cleaner.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Swan's mission is to help millions of people get into Bitcoin. So they built the fastest and easiest way to get started. It's just a matter of minutes to sign up and start buying Bitcoin with the Swan app. Introducing friends and family to Bitcoin has never been easier. And Swan now has zero fees on the first $10,000 worth of Bitcoin buys, so it's free to get started. But don't worry. If you're already a Swan client, your next 10K of buys are also free. If you love to recommend Bitcoin, and I know you do, Swan is a no-brainer. You can now take a friend from zero to Bitcoin in one quick conversation. Just tell them to search for Swan Bitcoin in their app store. It's really just a few minutes and completely free to get started. Again, search Swan Bitcoin to download the app. Where exactly are we storing these nuclear rods after they're used?
For the first few years, they get stored in a pool in the rod bays that are adjacent to the reactors. They'll be in like a peripheral building somewhere near the original reactor that it was loaded into. They stay there for a few years while the most harmful nucleides burn off. And then after, you know, I think somewhere around like 6-7 years, they'll pull them out and they'll put them into like a dry storage cask, which is basically just like a 6-meter-tall lead drum that's just stored on site and monitored. It's got so much shielding on it that you could stand right beside it with the most precise nuclear material detectors, and you won't even see a dose rate. But you can still like feel, they still radiate heat through the sides, so it's pretty cool.
I know this is going to be very different for each reactor because they're different sizes and use different amounts of fuel. But I guess what I'm looking for is some idea of how many of these fuel rods do you think they're having to dispose of on a yearly basis? Like, how much material has to get stored somewhere? And then, I guess, to compare it to maybe green energy, like windmills and stuff, there's a ton of, like, those fan blades that they use for those. I know that those are non-recyclable. They have to go in a landfill. They take up a ton of room. People haven't really figured out a way to repurpose them yet. So if we're talking about nuclear versus solar and wind, for example, both of those technologies have a lifespan where they are junked. Now they have to be disposed of. There's a lot of rare earth materials in those that are going to get wasted. Maybe they can get repurposed to some degree, but probably not 100%. So if we're going to compare apples to apples for, say, green energy like solar and wind, how much more efficient is nuclear as far as that's concerned? Just for pure storage and safety.
The number that I hear, well, like the analogy that I hear the most often, is that we could fit the entirety of the world's nuclear waste byproducts in like 2 soccer fields, 3 telephone poles high is roughly the volume of,
wow,
like the high level nuclear waste that needs to be find a proper storage for. And there is expectations that can be reduced through various recycling processes that will be available to us once we finally build the technology, but that's still a good decade or so away. But we are definitely working on it. It's a lot less of a footprint. Like, it is going to be harmful for a period of time and hazardous, but if stored correctly, it's completely negligible. Like, it's well monitored. It's stored in secured lead casks that you wouldn't even know that there's radiological material in it unless somebody told you that it was there. We take this stuff seriously.
To go back to your paper here and to start exploring the nuts and bolts of what you're working on and where you potentially see this technology headed and how Bitcoin fits in, let's start from the beginning. What is an SMR and why is it a big deal?
A small modular reactor is like the newest kind of idea in the nuclear industry, that we're going to build nuclear reactors that can be built in a factory assembly line type of style, and that the main components of the reactor will be easily transported in standard shipping crates and train freight or air freight. Basically, we're going to start building nuclear reactors similar to how we build ships and airplanes, where it's just going to be, there's going to be a facility that builds a standardized form factor and then just pumps them out, and they're easily and quickly deployed to an end site that will be prepared in advance. The housing for the reactor will need to be built custom for wherever it's being sited. But one of the things that I find of interest is that depending on the communities that we deploy these to, like, you could build the outbuildings, uniquely in a way that they follow like local cultural aesthetics. And then inside, the guts of the reactor would be the exact same as every other reactor of that design. So we could actually kind of make it fit in more with the community aesthetics, depending on where they are. Cause we intend to deploy a lot of these to like remote northern communities, which in Canada are mostly indigenous, so, and each one has a very like unique cultural and heritage, so that they wouldn't want this just big mechanical system dropped on them if we could build it in a nice way that fits with their cultural aesthetics. Yes. I keep using that word, but I like it. And then, so the SMRs, they're going to be coming in multiple sizes. It's any reactor that's less than 300 megawatts. So there's 70 different designs being proposed right now globally. The majority of them are just smaller versions of the existing, like, boiled water and pressured water reactors that most of the traditional fleet is made up of. But a vast amount of them are new cooling types. And some of them, yeah, new fuel designs and styles that will be able to be tested that have not really had the opportunity to be commercialized. Like, a lot of the technology that we're going to be deploying in the next, like, 5 to 10 years has already been proven in various, like, laboratory and research settings, like, back in the 60s and 70s. But the industry basically settled on one design to try and make it as economic as possible and just rebuild that same similar style of reactor as many times as possible to improve on the overall economics of building a fleet of reactors. That's kind of how France did it, Japan did it, Canada did it. The US is kind of unique because, like, almost every one of your reactors has something unique about it. They're not all quite the exact same. The plan is to just standardize about 6, 7, 8 of these SMR designs, anywhere from 5 megawatts for the mini versions up to, like, a 300 megawatt grid scale, and they'll apply to a much wider range of applications for where they can be deployed. Like, traditionally, like, when you're building a nuclear reactor, you have to kind of go for the scale and build, like, a gigawatt worth of capacity. But then if you're going to do that, you have to build it somewhere where you're going to have that demand, like a large city or a huge industrial load. But if you want to bring nuclear power to remote communities, you need to kind of do it in, like, little modules of, like, 5 or 10 or maybe 50 megawatts, depending on the communities that we're looking at. So it gives a lot more optionality for how we can deploy nuclear power beyond just our large grid scale operations.
When we're talking megawatts here to quantify energy, how many megawatts would a typical on-grid nuclear reactor in existence today churn out? So you said these SMRs are going to do 5 to 300, basically. What would a typical one in existence do right now? Do you know?
The ones that were just made operational in Dubai are, I think they're like 1.2 gigawatts each. The CANDU reactors that we have here in Canada, each one is about 700-800 megawatts. And then, like, they get built, like our reactor housings are, like, there's 8 reactors in one giant building. So that's like 800 times 8. So these puts out, like, yeah, right, like 4 or 5 gigawatts of power. And that's basically what services Toronto and the surrounding area.
Are these smaller reactors more autonomous than traditional ones? I mean, I'm assuming there must have to be some workforce there 24/7. To make sure nothing's going awry. But how technologically advanced are we talking about here? And is there a foreseeable future in your mind where there could potentially be one of these smaller setups that could be just remotely maintained and won't have to have personnel on site?
That is the end game. Yeah, there's an expectation that there will need to be at least a small contingent of, like, round-the-clock, like, operators and maintainers, but
people to call 911 and us show up and be like, yeah, just stay away from it. Stay far away.
We do walkthroughs, Ryan, at high-risk buildings in town. Josh, can you imagine just walking in? All right, boys. So here's the reactor. if this thing's open, just get out of here, I suppose.
When you walk in the building and you taste metal, you know you're done.
That doesn't sound like a safe environment.
Yeah. But yeah, that's key, Josh. That's a good question, because they can't, if they're a small rural, you know, 5 megawatt reactor, there's no way that you can have a bunch of scientists sitting around staring at screens and buttons. Like, it's going to have to be pretty operational for boneheads like us. Is that, I'm assuming that's obviously built into the plan and doable?
Yeah, that's the expectation, that there will definitely be somebody that needs to be competently trained on safety measures and what to do if things go wrong in the improbable case that they do. But for the most part, yeah, these remotely deployed reactors will be operated by a central command center that will be overseeing most of their operations. And then they will need some personnel just available to oversee it, but not fully involved in operating the reactor. Like a traditional operating room in a reactor has like a dozen people in it that are constantly monitoring everything all the time. That'll be monitored by somebody far away. They'll call in like a technician that'll just come in and just repair like a valve or what have you that needs to, little basic preventative maintenance type of stuff.
Do you see this as the future of, let's say we do end up going primarily nuclear. Say we go that route primarily in the future. Can you foresee these small reactors being the primary source for the majority of the world?
They definitely are going to end up at every corner of the globe. I'm certain of that. It's going to take a few decades, but that process is going to start probably early 30s. I would say like we're hoping to have them demonstrated by the late, at least a few demonstrated by the late 20s. And then once we've gotten proven a few applications, then yeah, all bets are off and we're just going to start pumping out these reactors as fast as we can. And as long as there are customers that are willing to purchase them, it's just going to get better and more efficient, and the learning curve will improve, and they'll be able to build them for cheaper, and then they'll, as they learn, they'll be able to improve efficiencies, and it'll just, that whole process of just learn by doing, and as each sequential reactor will be better than everyone that came before it, because they'll learn what they need to from the last one. I'm of the mind, like, what they could do is if these companies that are building these reactors, because they would need to kind of finance their operations, they could for themselves just build one of their own reactors, build a mining data center right beside it, and then just let that run, and then just take those profits and then just keep that self-fulfilling profits just pumping into the process of building a new reactor and then deploying it and building a new reactor and deploying it. And it'd be interesting to see the different strategies that these companies that are building the reactors, or the operators that ultimately like deploy them and own them at the end, because there's an infinite way that this can be configured and go about doing it, because now that we have a completely independent market from whatever is going on in your local area. I think it's going to be a game changer. It's going to be a lot of game theory and testing out ideas, but it's going to change power markets as we know them.
Let's pull on that string. Maybe even Bitcoin aside, before we get too deep into Bitcoin, why is this such a good form of energy production? You're saying you think it could be dispersed all over the world, be a primary form of energy production in, say, the mid-21st century. Why is it so effective and efficient and so likely to proliferate, in your view? Can you just kind of explain that from first principles for people that don't understand the efficiencies of nuclear?
Well, it's more just power in general. Like the three primary characteristics that we want from a power generation nowadays is that it's reliable, it's affordable, and it's low emissions. And nuclear, it's definitely reliable. It's definitely got low emissions. Affordability is questionable at the moment. We're hoping that the SMRs can drive down costs. And once we get more practice at licensing new reactor types and get over a lot of the regulatory and licensing hurdles, that we can drop the costs of building a nuclear reactor quite a bit. But like, it really depends on what your priorities are for your electricity systems. Like, for as long as most of us remember, reliability has been the priority. Like, you want to be able to turn the lights on when you hit the light switch. You don't want to have a lingering question mark as to whether or not the lights are going to come on. Like, would you rather have like dirt cheap electricity that sometimes you might even get paid for, but sometimes it's just not going to be there, or pay a moderate cost for your energy, but know that 100% of the time it's going to be available for you? And if it does go out, there's an army of technicians out there making sure that it comes back on as fast as possible. So it's nuclear, that's top of the stack for reliability and top of the stack for emissions, because like building a nuclear reactor is primarily steel and concrete and then your fuel, whereas the other types have a lot of different material requirements that I'm sure many are aware of, that it goes beyond the material capacity for what our planet could give us if we intended to go 100% renewables and batteries. Like, that's there's a lot of material that those yeah. require that I don't know if we have enough, but we've got a lot of steel and concrete.
That's exactly where I was going with the next question I was going to ask you, which is basically, in contrast to the amount of environmental impact you get from nuclear, you have to obviously dig up uranium, plutonium, 234, 238, whichever it is. But so I'm on Twitter the other day and just randomly run across this gentleman's tweet. His name is John Lee Pettymore, and he had this entire tweet storm about the environmental impacts of green energy. And there's a couple of highlights I took out of this that I wanted to mention while we're talking about this, because green energy at the final point, when you have a battery in a car or you have a battery on your wall in your house, it seems very green. You're not seeing any emissions from that, obviously. But to mine this stuff, to mine some of these rare earths, it takes 200 cubic meters of water for every ton of rare earth that they have to dig up. And that all of this water they use, they have to use, you know, highly toxic acids in order to refine the materials that they need out of the earth. And all of that water gets put back into the watershed, or quite a considerable amount, especially in the third world. And some of these numbers are astounding. It takes 18,740 pounds of purified rock to produce 2.2 pounds of vanadium. A couple other of these rare earths are just insane numbers here. This other one I've never heard of takes 2.6 million pounds of ore to get 2.2 pounds of it. And these places are just being strip mined in Africa and Asia. And a lot of times it's done by slave labor, you know, with pickaxes and absolutely no protection for themselves. It's kind of insane, the greenification that we see on the receiving end of this stuff, but it is entirely a different atmosphere when at the point of impact where this stuff's being dug out of the ground.
Yeah, I do appreciate, Josh, where you just went there, because it's worth zooming out and establishing that there's a couple disparate realities. One reality is that we have 8 billion people that demand an enormous amount of energy. The other reality is that we have an increasing number of people that want low carbon emissions. I'm not someone that can speak on the validity of that. One thing I was thinking through here, and I was sifting through a piece, and it just talking about 3/4 of the world's energy usage is from hydrocarbons, and all the other energy sources are either mined or constructed with equipment that runs on hydrocarbons, right? Yeah, so definitely. If we're going to provide energy and electrify the world for this many Homo sapiens in a carbon-free manner or a carbon-reduced manner, we are going to need a fuck ton of energy production, of clean energy production.
Yep.
And with where we're at currently, it seems very unlikely that's going to be soaked up completely by wind turbines and solar. And I think that really cues the case for nuclear. And where you're going here, Ryan, is like, what else is there that's gonna fill this gap? If people want clean energy, they're going to have to take on the minor risks of nuclear, because it is a very clean, incredibly efficient manner to pump out the energy needs of our species. And now with SMR technology, it's got the ability to be dispersed in all kinds of regions, both on and off grid, at all different scales. I mean, truly, reading your piece really cued me into, holy crap, this isn't maybe happening. This is very likely the direction this is going.
Yeah, that's the game plan.
Maybe we should take this time to dovetail this into how Bitcoin is going to affect this. Like, do you view this as the likely? I mean, this is kind of the way I'm viewing this after reading your piece and after, you know, obviously done a ton of research on how Bitcoin works and operates in mining specifically. It seems likely an easy path for these to proliferate would be mining companies acquiring them, you know, the 300 megawatt version, and then just putting in a giant tract of Bitcoin miners, and then also feeding the grid. It can go either direction. If the grid isn't buying up their energy for the right price, they mine Bitcoin, and vice versa. So these are on-demand users of energy, and they can be turned off and on instantly. Is that how you see this maybe bootstrapping itself to reality in the next 10 to 20 years?
Yeah, absolutely. It gives them the optionality to choose two completely independent markets to sell their electricity to. I expect you guys are familiar with Brandon Quidham's the pioneer species idea. It's essentially that. Like, we can drop a power plant wherever we want, and we have the built-in customer to take up that capacity and reduce the demand risk in the early years as more sophisticated energy users will enter that ecosystem, and then eventually they would crowd out the miners. And then, because of how easily the miners can travel across the world, as we saw when they all got booted out of China. As soon as they're not wanted somewhere, they go find a nicer home, and they will, and it'll play out like, was it Nick Carter's idea with the topographical map, where it'll just settle into all the cracks and just find all those little wasted energy sources, whether they're stranded geographically, whether they're stranded temporally. Like, it's just going to find all of those little inefficiencies in the energy system. Like, I expect most power generators will definitely have a non-zero amount of mining somewhere on their books, whether they're partnered with an existing miner that knows what they're doing, or they take the plunge and do it for themselves, or they just build the infrastructure and do hosting or what have you. There's any number of ways that they can do it. And then from there, you could also you could have it anywhere from 0 to 100%. Like, you could have these crazy pioneer Bitcoin miners that are just like, we're just buying a nuclear reactor, we bought some land, we're gonna set it up, we're just gonna put miners on it, and we're just gonna build our citadel around this. And like, I would not be surprised if there's someone out there, like some dude like friggin' like Chad Everett or Gideon Powell, like these cowboys that are out there mining in oil fields. Like, They would love to just get a power source that they can just drop wherever they want and just build around it. Like, it would be awesome. Like, the guys at Riot, they've proven that we can build these massive mining data centers. That with that operation that they've got going on is quite impressive. And then they're also pretty slick with their promotional videos. I was just watching one before we went live, so very, very impressed with their operations. That they seem to be doing quite well through this bear market, as opposed to some others that got a little over their skis. But it's just, there's so many different business models that can be tried out. Like, it's anywhere from 0 to 100, play around with it. You can try different ancillary services, whether they're playing as demand response or they just sit there as just collecting that beautiful Bitcoin for you. Or who knows, someday Jason Lowry's thesis plays out, and now then we have like a national security imperative that we just mine as much as you can. We've got this incentive to just plug all of the nuclear power into Bitcoin mining and just build more of it just for mining, just so that we can compete with our adversarial nations that are also doing the same thing and start getting crazy with this. Like, we're building something amazing here, and it's beautiful how it forces what would be competitive adversarial forces are essentially collaborating to build a more secure system. So the more competition there is, just the stronger it gets and the better it gets for the rest of us that just use this thing, especially for the billions of people that are still unbanked. Like, this just skips all of the traditional fiat finance systems, and they can get on with, they will definitely have a head start on us, especially from what I'm seeing with like adoption in Africa, El Salvador. It's the education is ramping up pretty quick, and their next generations are going to basically be Bitcoin native, while the rest of us are still arguing whether it's an asset that should have capital gains or not. Or they're going to be just using it because that's the only thing that they know.
Bitcoin 2024 is moving to the heart of Bitcoin country, Nashville. Nashville just feels like the proper place for a Bitcoin conference. I can't guarantee we will be on main stage or side stage or even performing a puppet show. I can, however, say that we will be hanging out with the plebs, and if we have no obligations, we will very likely be getting drunk. Bitcoin Magazine is introducing a new event this spring, Bitcoin Asia. It's shaping up to be an unmissable experience. Stay tuned for more info. Whether you want to visit Bitcoin Asia or Bitcoin 2024 in Nashville, we have a coupon code for you. Use coupon code BCB for 10% off any ticket to either event. That's code BCB.
Yeah, they're going to leapfrog the entire financial system as we know it today. It looks like that's a legitimate possibility for a lot of parts of the world that are largely unbanked. To double back, I want to talk about why Bitcoin is such a unique buyer of energy. And to do that, let's start with what demand risk is. That's a word you threw out here a couple minutes ago. What is demand risk for an energy utility or an energy producer? And then how does Bitcoin mitigate that? And why is it such a unique and unprecedented buyer of energy?
Yeah. So demand risk is essentially when you're intending to build a power asset somewhere and you have an uncertainty that you're going to have sufficient customers to take up that load. There's a good story that Harry Sudduk tells about a community that was going to build a hospital. So preemptively, before they built the hospital, they upgraded their energy infrastructure and added, I think it was like 20 megawatts or something to a transmission station. And then the financing on the hospital fell through and it never got built, but then the community was still on the hook for the power infrastructure upgrades. So I guess Harry came in there with grid, filled that space, and now the community is paying much lower power rates, and it's enabled them to have just this upgraded system that's more reliable, and use that guaranteed customer to make sure that they're still getting profits off of that excess capacity. And so then demand response, it's a feature, an ancillary service that power grids use where they can pay a customer that's using electricity to turn off when that electricity is needed by a higher priority customer. Like typically, like for the Bitcoin, another Bitcoin example is we saw in December, there during the storm in Texas, the Bitcoin miners shut down as much as like 1.5 gigawatts of capacity to free up to allow the grid to just distribute it to however it needed. So it's just the ability to kind of go up or down so that you could absorb surplus, or you can go down to when your local demand exceeds what your typical base load would be. And the reason that Bitcoin miners are the best at that is just they have a few really good properties. Like they're completely location agnostic. You can build them anywhere from a few kilowatts to gigawatts, as we've been seeing. They can easily be modulated up and down to follow loads on the demand side rather than trying to follow loads on the generation side, which it saves a lot of wear and tear on your generators. You don't have any like feedstock or physical product, so there's no like storage or transportation. So like that it just makes it easier to play like you're condensing this energy into a product that you can then sell into a market 24/7 instantly as soon as you've obtained it. It's like the perfect arbitrage for cheap energy where it is available to be able to use it anywhere on the world like immediately. Like typically they'll do that with like aluminum or steel mills in like remote locations that have like lots of hydro or geothermal. But then like you've got storage, you've got transport, you've got security, and there's all those extra superfluous costs that go around it. Whereas like Bitcoin's just an entry on a digital ledger. And if you got the keys, the coins.
I'm envisioning you at a nuclear conference, getting up in front of everybody and saying, all right, I have discovered an energy buyer that's totally adaptable, can be located anywhere, can be put in a ton of different configurations, can consume dense amounts of energy, and has no storage. Basically, to quote from your piece, these different points. Are you guys interested? And everyone in the crowd going, hell yeah, what is it? And then you standing there and going, Bitcoin. And everybody kind of looking at you with a blank stare. But that's true. Right now, as a buyer of energy in the marketplace, this thing exists and it checks every single one of these boxes for utilities and energy producers that many of them are selling, are paying to get rid of their energy. Like one thing that comes to mind anytime we talk about the energy implications of this thing is that incentives and money speak. Either this is going to work and is working in many areas, or it's not. And if it works, it's going to happen, right? Because if you're over here in one part of Canada and your counterpart, your competitor's over here in this other part, and their bottom line is massively increasing because they're doing this thing that is moving the needle on their bottom line, you are going to do that thing. So long as Bitcoin does anything remotely close to what we're expecting, even if mining isn't lucrative for a lot of current entities that are targeting that specifically, for a lot of these energy producers that have to pay to get rid of their energy or have to gate down and lose a lot of efficiencies, this is a dream come true.
I think it's also good for Bitcoin that some places are banning Bitcoin mining, because then it gives us a control group to compare against where it is working, and we can actually have a really really distinct separation and really see what happens when you do embrace it and what happens when you don't embrace it.
Yeah. Dan, and as you kind of enumerated there, I don't think the bottom line of a lot of these companies is very thick. You know what I mean? Like, they're operating on very thin margins, and anything that moves the needle on that is going to be incorporated. It has to be effectively, especially when you're watching a competitor do it. The game theory there will play itself out, as you said, as long as it works. And it clearly works. I mean, we're looking at hash rates right now near all-time highs. I haven't checked it in the last week, but I'm assuming it's still near there. And the price is in the toilet effectively compared to where it was a year ago. And people are still doing it. So there's got to be a lot of power transmission companies out there on board with this, because there's not a lot of people that can afford to lose money on a daily basis. Like, none of us could run. I don't know what you guys pay for power up in Canada, but for Dan and I, where we are, there's no way we could run anything profitably right now. Almost nothing.
Yeah, that sucks. You guys in Chicago, too. You guys have a few nuclear reactors there. You should have lots of power. But yeah, we do the time of use pricing in Ontario, where it tries to promote energy use during, like, late at night, where, and then they'll make it cheaper and then less energy during the day when it's more expensive. But from what I understand, in Ontario being a regulated grid, the generators, they get paid a set fee no matter what from, like, the provincial regulators. So any time that the price of electricity that they're generating goes below that threshold, that difference is actually made up by the taxpayer. So ultimately, if we can shore up the bottom lines of these reactors in regulated grids, you're benefiting the taxpayer and the ratepayer sometimes more than the generator itself. But then you're also, like, it's a win-win-win for everybody all around. Like, generator gets a more efficient operation, that all the taxpayers and ratepayers get to pay less. It looks like it's working.
Now, here's gaming out one kind of risk scenario. And I don't know if this is going to make any sense, but tell me if you've thought this through. Just like Bitcoin price, hash rate is a very relative thing. The definition of high and low on hash rate is going to be a needle that moves tremendously, likely through our lifetime. So what may seem high right now will at one point in the future seem minuscule. So here's my question. Let's say there are a lot of SMR energy utilities and countries and jurisdictions that decide to adopt this. And this is kind of becomes the go-to means for bootstrapping and handling the significant capital outlay in the beginning to get some return to do this Bitcoin mining. And we get to a point in the future where hash rate is just orders of magnitude beyond where it is today, where the returns on this opportunity dwindle significantly because so many people have entered the market to do it. And what the investors or the taxpayers or the jurisdiction is expecting on a return diminishes significantly to where it doesn't really match their expectations for how profitable it's going to be. Does that make sense? Is that a concern of yours? I know that's a long way down, and that would be great for Bitcoin. That means that Bitcoin's insanely secure and there's a ton of people mining it if reactors can't be profitable or use it. But is that something that's crossed your mind at all? Is a way that this could kind of drift off in the future?
It certainly has the potential that the diminishing, like, profit curves would happen if you're not keeping up with increasing hash rate. That's the way it works. And that's one of the reasons I expect that some of the most resilient miners going into the future are ones that adapt to doing, providing, like, a lot of ancillary services. So it'll be beyond just mining Bitcoin for the sake of mining Bitcoin. It'll be providing those demand response services. It'll be finding some way to make use of the heat, whether you're doing some sort of district heating operation or just have them installed as space heaters in people's homes, for God's sakes. Like, I've got an S9 plugged into my dryer, like, because I blew a heating element, so I had an S9 around, so I just ducted it into my dryer. Seems to work great. And then I have another one that's just used as a space heater. You just turn the fans down. It's just a light hum, no worse than the standard space heater that you'd buy off the shelf at your local hardware store. And you get the little bonus of mining Bitcoin. And, like, I'm definitely mining at a loss, but I'm expecting the Bitcoin that I'm mining now to be worth a lot more in the future, because, as we all know, there's fixed supply, and we're all going to be fighting over those last satoshis as they come trickling out of the block subsidies. It's going to be actually one thing that there was one chat group that I was in, and this idea came up of like leaving a future to incentivize mining in the future, because there was the worry about the potential like block subsidy going down and depending on fees. The idea of time locking a transaction into a specific future block with like say 10,000 sats now, but like 50 years, 10,000 sats might be worth a lot more than like a few bucks, and essentially leaves like a treasure hunt for the miners would coalesce. Like if knowing that that block is time locked with a really high fee sometime in the future, that would be a really valuable block to process at that point when we get to it. So like there's all kinds of crazy fun ideas going on in this ecosystem right now with how we can make sure that mining remains profitable into the future. And yeah, who knows, like we might have like nation states getting antagonistic towards each other and trying to censor each other's transactions so that some miners won't process these blocks, but then the other 2/3 of the network will process it fine. Like who knows if stuff like that comes about, but like it's not unexpected if it does when the nations start playing this game.
Mm. Yeah, being in the industry you're in, you've kind of got a better feel for how this is going than the average person does. I recently was reading about how there was some breakthroughs in fusion reactors. How close to that being a usable generator of power are we? Is that maybe within our lifetimes? Or do you think that from what you hear in the industry, that fusion reactors are just still a fugazi, still a dream that we might not achieve within the next century or so? It's really hard to tell as a layperson reading these things about how they're making incremental improvements in that technology, not having any idea how close or how far that really might be.
Yeah, optimistically, probably a few decades before we see fusion in any commercial capacity. Like the breakthrough is monumental for like a laboratory and research setting, but it still has a long way to go before it reaches commercial applications. And also my hope is that Bitcoin can absorb some of that excess generation and help them with their profitability early on. Pessimistically, like, yeah, it could still be as much as a century away before we can properly harness fusion, because there's a lot of specialty material requirements handling like that level of heat and magnetic fields that are required to contain a fusion reaction.
Just as a layperson, why is fusion so much more? Why is that the holy grail that is sought after in the industry? Why is it so much better than a fission or a reactor?
Because it's smashing together two very readily available molecules. Like it's just you're hit hydrogen and you're pushing hydrogen together. You'd be using a unique isotope of hydrogen. Tritium is the primary fuel for fusion reaction. It's hydrogen with two neutrons, and that's the primary fuel for fusion. So that gets smashed together with another hydrogen molecule, and then that's creates like if they get fused together with enough energy, they will form a helium atom, and then that process is just explodes an enormous amount of energy out of it. Like that's essentially the process that's happening inside of stars. But just the problem is it's so much heat and energy that we struggle to reach the material requirements to contain it in a long-term durable way. Like a lot of it uses a magnetic field to keep it in place, because it will get so hot that most of the metal that has been tried to contain it it'll start to melt and deform, because we still have a lot of long ways to go. So yeah,
straight up wizardry.
Yeah, you need like very powerful magnets to hold this together and keep it from spreading out. It's not crazy stuff like was it the Spider-Man 2 with Doc Ock? He was using tritium to do fusion, but it's not quite like that. But it's the general idea is you're smushing really small molecules together and they release an enormous amount of energy. Whereas with fission, you're taking large, heavy, unstable molecules and then you break them apart by giving just like a little bit more extra energy. Then they split apart and release a lot more energy. And then the trick of a reactor is to maintain the stability of that chain reaction so that it doesn't either collapse down to not emitting energy or emit so much energy that it runs away and you have a catastrophic situation like Chernobyl.
You had a story from El Salvador that you wanted to share with us. What was that?
Yeah, I got to experience the El Salvadoran hospital system, which was a very unique experience. So I was, after the first day of the Adopting Bitcoin conference, I had just watched a documentary. It was the Dare to Dream documentary, and it was starring a bunch of Bitcoiners that we know, like Vallis was in it, Mike Peterson, and some of the other guys from the Bitcoin Beach Project. And while watching it, Vallis was right in front of my wife and I. So then when the movie was over, we chatted and shook hands. And then, like, less than 10 minutes later, we're on our way out. We're heading to the car out in the parking lot. And my wife hands me the parking ticket, and I look down for a moment. And then, being tall, I have a tendency to bump my head on things. And there was a beam just right at the perfect height, took it right in the center of my head. And I'm used to hitting my head on things, so I just kind of shrugged it off and walked to the car, and then get to the driver's side and see my reflection in the window, and my face is just dripping blood. And then I look up at my wife, and she's like, "Holy shit, what the hell just happened to you?" And then there's some two security guards over behind us, and they're like, "Oh, hospital. Like, they didn't speak English, so there was that challenge. Just be like, "Yes, we know hospital. Where is the hospital? We don't know where we're going. We've never been in San Salvador before." And she runs in to go grab some ice, and she just, like, dumps out her swag bag and fills it with ice. And she's like, "Hold this on your head and just wait for me." And then hindsight, we should have, like, called somebody that we know that was there and that knows the area, like someone like Carcelo Martinez that we had been chatting with a little bit. Like, he probably would have helped us out. But nope, it was too late. We were in the car. We were on our way. We were going to the hospital. Find the hospital. It's the wrong hospital. And then the security guard comes out, and he's like, "No, you can't go here. This isn't for tourists. This is, like, the national hospital. It's the special one." So he sends us to this other hospital at the other side of the city. And then we get there, and the hospital is completely surrounded by walls, barbed wires around it, like just about every other structure in El Salvador. And so we just park on this shady looking street. There's, like, a few, like, little shanty shops along the way towards the entrance of the hospital. The triage is just a fold-out table right outside after we get let in through the gate. Yeah, and then my wife goes in. She goes and does the paperwork, and, like, we couldn't communicate what happens, but I just, like, show them my head, and they're like, oh yeah, we need to deal with that. So they go in, they find somebody that speaks English that was very handy, that they had a few doctors that we could communicate with. But I get sat down in the waiting room while I'm waiting for all the paperwork and registration to be done. I look over, I'm sitting beside this bald guy that's covered in tattoos, and I'm just like, oh. And I look a little closer, he's wearing full manacles. And then I look a little further back, there's like an army guy locked and loaded sitting beside him, just being like ready in case this guy acts up. And I'm just like, well, at least you're here. This is an interesting situation that I'm not into every day. And then look over to my right, like, the rest of the waiting room is just all families. But I'm sitting beside this definite gang member. Like,
what a shit show.
Did they suture you up nice and tight? There's no scars?
Oh, yeah. No, it was perfect. Then even when I came back to Canada, they were like, oh, they did an amazing job with that. That was great. And, like, we were in and out in under an hour. Like, they brought us in, they sutured up the head, they took a quick x-ray to make sure that I didn't do anything bad to the skull. Gave me some antibiotics and sent us on our way in under an hour. Like, if that had been in, I hate to rag on my own country, but if that was in Canada, that would have been minimum 3-4 hour wait before you're even seen. And then who knows how long the rest of the process would have taken. And then you would have had to go to an external pharmacy that probably wouldn't have been open to go get the medication. And yeah, it would have been an interesting difference between the two systems. So I'm like, I don't know if I was getting special treatment because you're just the tourist gringo coming into the El Salvadoran hospital, and they're just like, get this guy through as quick as possible. It was a hell of an adventure. And then we get back to our hotel, because we weren't even staying in San Salvador, we were down near the coast in El Tunco, so we had still had like a half hour drive to get home, winding roads down, like, basically down the side of a friggin' volcano, because, like, I'm used to Ontario, all of our major roads here are just straight lines, just trees and rock cuts. Just, we don't go around the landscape, we just go right through it. Whereas, yeah, El Salvador was meandering around all of the curves. So it was a wild ride coming back home with a head injury, still a little delirious from losing a lot of blood. And my wife's just like, why do you think this is funny? It's like, because we get to tell everybody I went to a hospital in El Salvador. And she ragging on me. Just like, stop laughing about it.
They got you in and out because they knew you were a Bitcoiner. It was like that. That's how they work in there down there. They go, "Tienes Bitcoin?" And if you say yes, they go, "Rapido, rapido." This guy's gonna be loaded one day. Get him in and out.
We got to attract more of these gringos down here now.
For sure. what a crazy story, though. It is not fun getting injured overseas. It's not fun getting injured anywhere, but completely out of your comfort zone. Glad it was a good experience. Yeah. Glad you're okay. And was that in the middle of the conference? Were you able to finish out the conference okay?
Oh, yeah. That was after day one. And then came back day two, did my presentation. And then day three was at Bitcoin Beach. And then day four was just a vacation day where I walked the beach again, took some surf lessons, took in, did the tourist stuff with as much energy as we had. Would have been nice to go and like hike the volcanoes or waterfalls, but man, I'm in my late 30s, I'm starting to feel old. I haven't been taking good care of myself. We'll get there. It's inspiration to get myself back into shape that I can go and do those things.
Yeah, you got to eat meat.
It was a lot of fun nonetheless, and I highly recommend, if you get the opportunity, go to El Salvador.
It's on my bucket list.
And you already know you're going to get to use your Bitcoin. I used it at Walmart. I used it just by coconuts from just the random street vendor that's on the way to the beach. It's exciting. It's giddy when you get to use your Bitcoin in the real world.
Mm-hmm. Brian, we appreciate you joining us today. Give a handoff here to our audience.
Yeah, it was great chatting with you guys. It's an honor to be on your podcast. You guys have had some pretty heavy hitters that come in this room. On Twitter, I go by Nuclear Bitcoiner. I'm basically out there cheerleading for the idea of mining Bitcoin with nuclear power. In the real world, I'm just a pleb that works in the nuclear industry that's trying to influence some scientists that are doing modeling work. Let's just say I'm just trying to give them an extra variable to incorporate into their models to see what they'll spit out. And then ultimately I'd like to run a few simple scenarios and then culminate that with something a little more substantial. Like, I was talking when the last podcast I did was with Daniel Prince, and he put the idea in my head of getting nuclear for Madeira. And then it was like an island with a controlled system that's isolated is a really good modeling scenario to build up to. It would be interesting to see what sort of scenarios we can develop for a system like that, and then that can be replicated for a lot of other places.
If you build a reactor at Canadian Nuclear Laboratories in, like, you know, 3 years afterward, everyone's gonna be like, why is everybody driving an Aston Martin DB9 or a Bentley? Like, what the fuck's going on over there? And you're like, don't worry about it, that humming over there, pay no attention. You know, the incentives will rule. I think that is one of my takeaways from your piece. It, as I said earlier, if Bitcoin does anything remotely close to what we're anticipating, it's going to be something that a lot of energy utilities, and especially those in nuclear, are going to want to plug in next to the honeypot.
Yeah, the incentives change a lot. I'm excited for it. And yeah, I think four years is when we're expecting to have our first SMR built at Canadian Nuclear Labs. That is the goal. And my goal is to make sure that we have at least a small contingent of miners to just prove the claims that are being made. But I'm sure by then we'll have all kinds of examples of this in operation. So I'll have lots of inspiration to draw upon.
Yeah, keep us in the loop and keep us updated about what's going on with that. We're very interested.
Yeah, sell us some hash rate under the table too once you get it running.
Yeah, we would take a small nuclear reactor and, you know, power our houses with it too, if you can get us one of those.
Ship it here to the suburbs of Chicago.
No big deal, right? Shipping that over country line.
The one that we're building is an American design. I think they're actually building one at the University of Illinois. I think that's where one of the demonstrations is going to be built. It'll probably be a year or two after the one that we get, but they're barking up the same tree as us. There's going to be a lot of these things popping up all over the place at like universities and existing nuclear sites. So it's going to be an exciting new future for nuclear. And if we can attach the the Bitcoin rocket ship to it, it's going to be amplified immensely and to help a lot of people get out of energy poverty, because that is ultimately the end goal, is to reduce poverty by bringing as much energy to people as possible. That's my goal.
Great mission. We appreciate you, Ryan.
Absolutely. It's great. Great being here with you.
If you enjoyed this conversation and you're appreciating our content here at Blue Collar Bitcoin, you can genuinely help us extend our reach by taking a minute to leave us a review on Apple, subscribing to our YouTube channel, or liking and subscribing on your app of choice. Josh and myself, Dan, are also active on Twitter at @blue_collarBTC, where we regularly post about Bitcoin, economics, food, and all sorts of other bullshit. If you want to send us questions or comments, our email is bluecollarbitcoinpodcast@gmail.com. Lastly, we take our partnerships on this show extremely seriously. We believe in these companies and their utility. Information, promo codes, and links to all our sponsors can be found down in the show notes. Take care, folks. Have a great week, and we look forward to you joining us again on the Blue Collar Bitcoin Podcast. Yeah.